What is our relationship with the planet? What are we doing with the world on which we are living? How are we treating it? How is it likely to treat us if we go on treating it as we are now? And I shall begin with a quotation from the Bible. It comes from the Psalms, as far as I remember. And it goes like this. The trees of the Lord are full of sap, the cedars of Lebanon which he hath planted. And there's a phrase, too, in the Song of Solomon, where the face of the beloved is compared to the cedars. It says, his countenance is as Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. And these great trees, of course, have a kind of mythical quality. We've all heard of them from our earliest years. Hospitals are named after them. They've become a sort of household word. And I remember 4.5 years ago, when for the first time I went to the Middle East, one of the things I was most interested in seeing was precisely the cedars of Lebanon. Well, Lebanon, as you probably know, is a very small country which consists of a coastal strip not more than a few miles wide. At the foot of towering mountains, I think they go up to about 10,000 feet, and the mountain range, I suppose, is about 100, 150 miles long and 25 or 30 miles wide. And I expected, when I drove up into it, to find the cedars of Lebanon in profusion on this great range, as undoubtedly they once were. Well, we drove and drove for hours up enormous hills, and finally came, after miles upon miles of absolutely barren country, mountainous country, and came upon an enclosed space in which there were approximately 400 cedars. And flying over the range later on, I saw two or three other such groves, and I believe there are in all perhaps 1,500 or 2,000 cedars left. This is all that remains of the gigantic forest which supplied King Solomon with the timbers for his temple, and which for centuries supplied Egypt, which grows no trees of its own except palm trees, with all the timber it required. If you remember, Solomon made a treaty with Hiram, king of Tyre, in which Hiram agreed that his slaves should bring the timbers down to the coast, and that they should then be towed in floats to whatever port was appointed by Solomon, and then dragged up to Jerusalem. Well, now, of course, nothing is being cut in this area, and such few trees as remain are being very carefully preserved. Now, this illustrates in a very striking way what man has been doing to his planet. Here we had a magnificent forest. These trees are very fine. You must have seen them in botanical gardens. The specimens, of course, grow all over Europe now. They've been imported there, and they do very well, even in temperate climates. This is, as I say, a really painful but only too illustrative example of what man has been doing over the course of the centuries. He has found a profusion in nature, and in all too many cases, he has completely devastated what he has found. There is a phrase which Chateaubriand has, which is very striking. He said, les forêts précèdent les peuples et les déserts les suivent. Forests precede civilization and deserts follow it. And this, of course, is only too true over great areas of the world. And what I want to talk about today is precisely this influence of man. We have to remember that since he has been on Earth, which is anything from 500,000 perhaps to 1,000,000 years, a man has been increasingly a profound geological force, changing the face of the planet upon which he lives, changing it sometimes for the better, but changing it in all too many cases for the worst. In any case, the important thing is to remember that he has changed it. In the 19th century, the environmentalist school spoke of environment as conditioning cultures, as creating cultures, and left out of account altogether the fact that cultures condition environment, that there is a two-way movement between the environment and the human culture, and that man has certainly done almost as much to change the environment as the environment has done to mold the course of human history. For example, it now seems pretty clear, most ecologists, I think, will agree to this, that certainly the tropical grasslands, and quite possibly the grasslands of the temperate zone, were actually created by man and maintained by man in their open grassy state, and have been created and maintained like this for hundreds of thousands of years. Well, now let us begin briefly by talking about the positive contributions which man has made in changing the planet. I suppose the most important contributions are those he has made in bringing valuable plants from plants or animals from one part of the world to another. For example, in classical times, we had such trees as the peach, the plum, walnuts, almonds, brought from the Near East and Middle East and even from the Far East, and acclimatized throughout the Mediterranean. And we had such valuable fodder plants as alfalfa and certain types of clover brought from the Mediterranean and domesticated throughout Europe and later on in the New World. And in the other direction, such plants as peas and vines were carried from the West into China. So that there has been, throughout human history and even in periods of prehistory, a very important work performed by man in covering the whole earth, wherever it would bear the tolerate the plants, very valuable food plants from one part of the world to the other. And the same, of course, is true with the animals. The most obvious case is the importation of the horse into the New World. The Indians who lived here did all their hunting on foot until the Spaniards and the first English settlers introduced the horse when they rapidly took to this new quadruped. And you see the same thing, for example, in South America. I was in Peru this summer, and it's very interesting to see there the only domestic animal which the Incas possessed was the llama, the alpaca, and the vicuña. And the llama can, at a pinch, carry about 20 or 30 pounds on its back. And this was all they had, except for human beasts of burden, for transporting goods up and down those extraordinary mountain trails in the Andes. Well, they now have adopted the sheep, which has even entered into their folklore, into the Indian folklore of the Andes, and has become a kind of native animal there. And of course, another interesting importation from the East into Europe was the cat, which came from Egypt and really didn't make itself much at home in Western Europe until the end of the Dark Ages and the early Middle Ages. I mean, we can see, for example, in the old fairy story of Dick Whittington, how extremely valuable cats were, how remarkable they seemed. And in the Saxon law preceding the conquest of England, a cat was so valuable that anybody who killed somebody else's cat was expected to pay for it by pouring enough wheat so as to make a pile high enough to cover the cat suspended by its tail. And this was the value of a cat in the 11th century in England. And the, as I say, these interesting creatures came from Egypt, because the local wild cat of Western Europe was never tamed. And in the same way, in classical times, the invaluable domestic chicken was imported from India into the classical world and has been with us ever since laying eggs. It's a strange thing to realize that in the earlier classical period, people had no eggs, and that this is a relatively recent importation. And in the same way, of course, so to go back to plants, we have this revolutionary introduction of potatoes into the old world from the new, and also equally revolutionary, the importation of corn, maize, from South and Central America into Africa, Asia, and Southern Europe. Well, these, as I say, are immensely important changes which man has wrought for the good. And I don't think I have time really to go into the history of the views about man as a changer of nature. In general, we may say that the realization began in the late 18th century, and the great classical work on the subject was written in the 1860s by George Perkins Marsh, who was the first American ambassador to the New Kingdom of Italy, which is collects all the European material to date on the subject of man and nature, and sets it forth in a kind of philosophical context. And the book remains an extremely valuable one, and is one of the great precursors in this field. Well, now we have to consider the reverse of the medal. Man has, as I say, done great constructive things to the world in which he lives, but unfortunately he has also committed enormous destruction. He has lived only too frequently on his planet, almost as a parasite living upon the host it infests. And whereas many parasites are sensible enough not to destroy their host, because after all, if they destroy their host, they destroy themselves, man is not one of the sensible parasites, and has very often lived upon his host in such a way as absolutely to ruin the creature on which he is living. And let us now consider some of the ways in which man has proved most destructive, some of the things which he has done to this world on which he finds himself. We will begin with the animals. This, I must say, is a very depressing chapter, but if one looks at the statistics compiled, for example, by the International Society for the Protection of Nature, one reads that, what are the figures? I think 50 species of mammals only were wiped out during the 19th century, and 40 more since 1900, and 600 species are probably doomed to extinction at the present time. This is a sad and melancholy picture, this thought that we are wiping out creatures of extraordinary beauty and interest, which are rapidly disappearing. And some of the examples are very unpleasant to record. There is, for example, the case of the traveler pigeon in this country, which existed at one time in such fantastic numbers that its flights used to darken the sun. And in the early colonial and post-independence days, one of the amusements of the early inhabitants used to be to drive out to the woods where these pigeons nested in incalculable numbers and knock the nests down with the young squabs in them and fill entire wagons with these creatures and drive them home. Obviously, they simply couldn't eat most of them, and many of them were just thrown away to rot by the roadside, just as happened with the bison in innumerable numbers rather later. And now the traveler pigeon is completely extinct. And the bison is nearly extinct. It is now having probably once counted 50 to 60 million head of bison on the plains. There are now a few thousand left. And again, the record of the wanton slaughter of these animals is a very painful and distressing one. And there are numerous other cases of interesting and curious animals destroyed. Another very odd one is the Indian rhinoceros, which is practically extinct now. And it was extinct for a very curious reason. Extinct owing to the fact of human superstition, above all Chinese superstition. The rhinoceros horn was regarded as a kind of love filter or amulet. And the enormous prices used to be paid for the horn. I remember years ago going to visit the great warehouse in the docks of London where ivory and horn and tortoiseshell and pearl shell were brought in and auctioned off. And I was very surprised at the time to find that rhinoceros horn was selling at a considerably higher price than ivory, and entirely for this reason, to supply the Chinese market with what was supposed to be an aphrodisiac, which was clearly it was not. And to satisfy this human superstition, these interesting creatures now have been butchered off, and they are, of course, also rapidly disappearing in Africa, the kindred species. And in many parts of the world, too, the crocodile is disappearing. And as I shall mention in a future lecture, this highly unsympathetic animal, the crocodile, is probably... we shall miss him because he performed a very valuable function, as it's now suddenly being discovered, and that when we eliminate him from the rivers of the tropics, we are doing damage which may be extremely serious. This is a question which I shall have to discuss at a later time. At the present, I'm merely pointing out that there has been this wholesale massacre of animals, and that this thing is going on. And that actually now the great wild species of Africa survive solely, really, because there are these national parks in various parts of Africa, the Kruger National Park in the south, the various parks in the Belgian Congo, where these animals are carefully protected and will presumably survive for the benefit of science and for the delight of people who wish to go outside the all-too-human world and see what the rest of the creation looks like. Well, so much for the animals destroyed by men. Now let us consider the plant world. We will begin with the forests. I've already talked about the cedars of Lebanon. Here was an immense forest of magnificent trees, which has virtually totally disappeared, leaving the mountains to be eroded As you drive through the mountains, you find that in many cases the erosion has washed away all the topsoil and nothing remains except the naked rock. And in many cases it's quite clear that it can never be reafforested. There just isn't any soil on which to grow trees again. And this same situation, of course, has arisen again and again in every part of the world. Just to indicate the sort of thing which is happening today in this country, there are, of course, great forests remaining in the United States, but the annual cutting of timber still exceeds annual growth by about 50%. Well, it's quite obvious you can't go on with this kind of thing for very long and hope to have many forests. Now, let us briefly go into the reasons why forests are cut. Obviously, forests have to be cut for a number of reasons, but they also have to be, those that remain, have to be carefully preserved. Forests have been cut, of course, simply to extend the area for agriculture. This has been going on from time immemorial. The men have been burning and cutting forests in order to create new places where they could plant food crops. And the agriculture probably began about 8,000 BC, and the whole process was greatly speeded up after the beginning of the Iron Age, when it became possible with the use of iron plowshares to break soils much too heavy for the wooden plowshares which had been used in the past. And again, this the possibility of a greater spread of agriculture, another possibility came towards the 8th century AD when what appears to be an extraordinarily simple invention, but in a very, very important invention, was made, namely the horse collar, which permitted horses to pull a much greater weight and to put much more strength into their pulling than they were able to do with the previous forms of harness. And as I say, these technological advances, plus a slow but steady rate of increase of population, have naturally led to the clearing of enormous forests. Then, of course, there is a much earlier reason for clearing forests was in the period of the hunting period. All hunting tribes have liked not to destroy forests, but to clear them. To increase visibility, hunters have always tended to burn off the underbrush, which permitted the game to be hunted much more easily than it can in a very dense forest. And this process has been going on for an immensely long period. And then the equally important in more recent times has been the use of timber for industry and building. And this, naturally, the destruction of forests around urban centers has been very great because of this industrial use of timber. One of the most important uses, of course, was for fuel. For example, if you read the Diderot's articles in the Encyclopédie of the 1770s, you will find a very, very interesting account of the provisioning of Paris with wood for burning, for space heating. And curious to find, for example, that all the forests around Paris had been largely exhausted and that the wood was coming in from hundreds of miles away, being floated down in great rafts down the Seine and its tributaries, and the rafts being moored off the quays of Paris, and the wood taken and distributed. And Diderot already, who was an extremely intelligent man and one of the few intellectuals of the period who was deeply interested in the technological progress of his time, he says this cannot go on, and our only hope, of course, is to get down to coal for space heating. And in fact, at about this time, coal had to be used on a considerable scale and did help to save the forests. Well, then, besides space heating, of course, there was the metallurgy. All ores were smelted with charcoal, and steel was for the first time made with coke only at the beginning of the 18th century, so that you can imagine there was a prodigious destruction of forests wherever there was a metallurgical industry, and in the same way there was an immense destruction wherever there was a glass industry. Glass is a very early invention. It goes back to about 3000 BC, but it was then cast glass, which was very expensive and difficult to make. And the art of blowing glass was probably not perfected until the 1st century AD, but it very rapidly led to the formation of glass industries all around the Mediterranean and as far north as Cologne and as England, which the consequences of which were an enormous massacre of the forests. Then another very important reason for the destruction of forests was, of course, partly house building, but very important was shipbuilding. And it's interesting, if you look into the history of this, to find how soon the timbers suitable for building ships were exhausted in Western Europe. For example, the French Navy, from about the end of the three quarters of the way through the 17th century onwards, couldn't find sufficient suitable timber in its own territory, and was largely supplied by timber coming from as far afield as Albania. The Spaniards, at the time of their great naval expansion during the 16th century, were depending not upon wood in Spain, but upon wood coming from the Baltic. You will find then again in Pepys's diary, Pepys, as you remember, was an employee at the British Admiralty, and he has a reference saying, "God knows where our oak is to come from." And in fact, the oak was running out. Well, during the 18th century, the period of Britain's naval supremacy, the oak for its ships was predominantly coming from the New World. It was oak from New England and the eastern seaboard of this country. And for the rest, it was teak coming from the Indian Empire. So that one sees that already the there was a serious shortage of the great hardwood trees in the Western world, which had to be made good by imports from other parts of the earth, and fortunately, perhaps the the Battle of Hampton Roads in 1862 proved that the iron ship was definitely superior to the wooden ship, and consequently the necessity for massacring these forests of slow-growing trees ceased. I mean, for that reason, for the reasons of shipbuilding, we were able to shift from one source of materials to another. And in this way, we were able to spare a great many of the hardwood forests. Well, the area, I think, where one sees the deforestation most clearly, certainly in the old world. I mean, you see it terribly clearly in the northwest here and in and around the Great Lakes. But the area where it is most visible in the ancient civilized world is around the Mediterranean. Here the forests in the past used to come right down from the northern part of Europe, completely down to the Mediterranean coast. And there are today only very few areas on the Mediterranean coast where you will still see traces of the ancient forest. You will see it, for example, in the south of France. There is a small forest east of Hyères called the Forêt des Morts, where there is about 100 square miles of forest still left, which is all that remains of the great primeval forest of ancient times. This had already largely disappeared even in classical times, and the remainder just vanished during the Middle Ages, largely due to the glass industry and the soap industry of Marseilles and the shipbuilding industry of Toulon and Marseilles, and nothing is left. For those who are interested in landscape painting, it's a curious thing to realize that what we consider the typical landscape of Provence, such as is represented in the pictures of Cézanne, this typical Provençal landscape, which one imagines to have been forever the form of Provence, is a relatively modern landscape. It represents hills which have been completely stripped of their forests and which have now been weathered down practically to their bare bones, and which are probably, many of them, hopeless cases. They probably can never be reafforested. They are extremely picturesque as they stand, but we must remember that they are a product of degeneration and destruction. And the same thing, of course, is true of other parts of the Mediterranean. For example, if you go to Tunisia, you go to drive inland from Sousse, you will see an extraordinary sight in the middle of the desert. You will see an absolutely gigantic amphitheater, El Djem, which is second only in size to the Colosseum of Rome, standing in the middle of nowhere. Now, this El Djem was situated in a province which in Roman times was called Frugifera, the fruitful, fruit-bearing province. And today it is 80% completely desertic, with a few Arab huts scattered about at the foot of these gigantic buildings. And this same picture occurs again and again. You will get the Homer, for example, speaks about the tall oaks and pines of Sicily. Well, you can cross the Sicily from one side to the other and hardly see a single tree. There are a few places where attempts at reforestation have been made. But this once extremely well-forested, well-wooded country is now completely naked. And the same thing is true of Greece. The same thing is true of Palestine and Syria. The same thing is true of Spain, which once had magnificent forests over a great part of its area, and which is now predominantly a bare, naked country. Then we must... Then you see the same thing in southern Italy, of course, where there are enormous areas of bare, stripped land. And here it's worth recording something which has only been discovered within the last few years. It was supposed that the Italy, the southern Italy, assumed its present barren aspect towards the end of the Roman Empire, that the sort of breakdown of agriculture at that time led to this deforestation and loss of fertility. Actually, a recent discovery has shown that this is not true. During the war, the Royal Air Force made an almost complete map, air map of Italy. It was photographed very carefully with slanting light, which permits one to see the archaeological traces. And it was found, to everybody's surprise, that what had previously been supposed to be barren since the time of the Roman Empire was in fact quite fertile towards the end of the Roman Empire, and even during the Dark Ages, that you can see the traces of the fields, the traces of the terracing, the traces of the foundations of peasant houses over this area. And it is now realized that the destruction of the this fertile and forested area in southern Italy was a consequence of the introduction during the 12th and 13th century of the Spanish methods of sheep herding, which were completely ruinous to the country and which left it in its desolate state in which we find it at present. Now we have to pass to another area of destruction, in some ways even more important, or at least as important as the forest destruction, which is the destruction of the soil. Well, I can't go into the question of the nature of the soil. This will have to be spoken about slightly in another lecture. But the soil is, of course, a living organism. It owes its fertility to the existence within itself of great numbers of ecological communities of microscopic and macroscopic organisms of every kind. And that the topsoil, which contains almost all the fertility of the soil, is rarely more than about a foot deep. So that we can say, actually, that the 2.8 billion people now inhabiting the planet depend upon a layer of soil not more than about 10 inches deep. And that we know that left to itself, it takes 300 to 1,000 years to create an inch of this soil. So that one sees the extreme danger which any process causing soil destruction leads to. Soil erosion, of course, happens all the time. One of the regular processes of geological change takes place through erosion. But there is an immense difference between the slow erosion of nature left to itself and the rapid and destructive erosion which takes place when man wantonly strips the land of its vegetable cover, cuts down the forests, or tears up the grass, or performs bad agricultural processes which leave the land vulnerable to the wind and the rain. And man, unfortunately, has been committing these crimes against nature for a very long time. Curiously enough, one of the best descriptions of erosion is given by Plato in his dialogue, The Critias, where he speaks of his own native country of Attica. And it's worth reading this thing, because it's remarkable how accurate the description is. He says, in comparison of what there was, there are remaining only the bones of the country's wasted body, all the richer and softer parts of the soil having fallen away, and the mere skeleton of the land being left. But in the primitive state of the country, its mountains were high hills covered with soil, and the plains were full of rich earth, and there was abundance of wood on the mountains. Of this last, the traces still remain, For although some of the mountains now only afford sustenance to bees, not so very long ago, there were still to be seen roofs of timber cut from trees growing there, which were of a size sufficient to cover the largest houses. Moreover, the land reaped the benefit of the annual rainfall, not as now, losing the water which flows off the bare earth into the sea, but having an abundant supply in all places and receiving into herself and treasuring it up in the close clay soil, it let off into the hollows these streams it absorbed from the heights, providing everywhere abundant fountains and rivers, of which there may still be observed sacred memorials in places where fountains once existed, but exist no more. Such was the material state of the country, which was cultivated, as we may believe, by true husbandmen who made husbandry their business, and were towers of honor. Well, this is rather interesting. He gives this description of a frightful process of erosion, which was already taking place in the 5th century BC. But he ascribes almost divine qualities to the husbandmen who obviously caused this erosion. The reason was that, rather like Aylesworth Huntington in 40 years ago, he attributed all the trouble not to man, but to a change in climate. He thought that that what had happened to Attica was a series of deluges which had done this thing. But I think that probably if he hadn't been so interested in Platonic ideas and had been a little more concerned with what husbandmen were actually doing, he would have seen that it was precisely these divine husbandmen who had done things to the soil which had left it in the ruinous and impoverished state in which the Greeks even of that time found it. And heaven knows that it was relatively fertile then compared with what it is now. One may say that perhaps he would have done better to devote more attention to these dreadfully practical problems of nature than to the rather abstract metaphysical problems which he was engaged upon. And one can say something of the same kind in relation to Socrates, who, if you remember, said that he saw no object in going outside the city walls because everything of interest was within the city walls, and that his business was solely with men. But after all, men do have to live on the soil and live in community with nature. And again, one wonders whether Socrates wouldn't have done more good to his fellows if he had paid a little more attention to what went on outside the city walls as well as within. There are, of course, enormous amounts of erosion have been going on all over the world. I can't possibly enter into all the lists of them. Those of you who are acquainted with the literature of the conservationists here will know what an immense amount of land has been destroyed in an extraordinarily short space of time by ignorance and wantonness here. And the same thing is true over many other areas of the world. There are vast areas of erosion in China, vast areas in Africa, vast areas in South America, vast areas in Southern Europe. And this dreadful thing goes on and on. When man lives like a parasite upon his soil, destroying it while he tries to live upon it. And needless to say, this whole process becomes progressively more and more dangerous as more and more people are born into the world and have to be supported. And the increasing pressure naturally drives peasants and farmers to attempt to get more out of the soil, so that there are extraordinary problems, which we will have to go into at a later time, in regard to policy in relation to this great fact of human destructiveness. It is an enormous and frightening fact, the combination of destruction plus population increase is clearly one of the major problems confronting human beings at the present time. Now, it mustn't be thought that all primitive peoples all the time and everywhere have been destructive. On the contrary, in many parts of the world, quite primitive peoples have shown an extraordinary understanding of preserving and conserving the soil. As I said just now, I had the opportunity of visiting the Inca regions of the Andes this summer. And this is an extraordinary sight, to see the Inca terraces rising from the floor of the Urubamba River up 2,000 or 3,000 feet up the side of a mountain. This wonderfully careful terracing made with dressed stone, some of the terraces are used to this day, and which did permit quite intensive agriculture on slopes literally of often of 35 degrees, I think, of incredibly steep slopes. And you go to a place, for example, like Machu Picchu, this fantastic city built on a sugarloaf hill, and there you discover that its population, which was quite small, probably not more than 2,000 or 3,000, was able to survive for a long time, 2 or 3 centuries at least, on its elaborate system of terracing. And you will find other extraordinary examples of terracing in Indonesia and the Philippines. Among the Igorotes in the Philippines, this wonderful rice cultivation. You'll see the same thing in Java. And there's good reason to suppose that many of these rice-growing terraces have been in use for 1,000, perhaps 2,000 years even. And this is, of course, an extraordinary achievement. But, of course, one of the saddest things is to realize that the good example which certain people have set in certain parts of the world has certainly not been followed in other parts of the world. Indeed, in the Inca area, you will find these remains of the ancient pre-Spanish terraces within 30 miles of barley cultivation around Cusco, where the worst kind of farming practices have been used, and the most fearful gullying and erosion is seen. I mean, here one wonders, why on earth couldn't they have taken the hint? But evidently, this, as somebody said, the greatest lesson of history is that nobody ever learns the lessons of history. And of course, it's another very extraordinary fact that the methods of contour plowing, which have now being applied more and more to agriculture in this country, were really not developed until the 30 years ago, 25 years ago, and that it should have taken all this time for a process which was already apparent to Jefferson, who talked about soil erosion and soil exhaustion, that it should have taken another 150 years for the remedies to be generally applied. Again, this is a most disturbing fact, all the more disturbing now when one realizes that owing to the increasing pressure of population upon resources, there is extraordinarily little time. Now, briefly, I think I have time to go into some of the methods which have been used for destruction. There are several most powerful instruments of destruction which man has employed during the ages. First of all, let's begin with overgrazing. This has been going on at least since the domestication of sheep and goats, which probably goes back to 7,000 or 8,000 years. And here there's a very ironical fact. We generally feel a great sympathy for Abel and great dislike for Cain. But let us never forget that Abel was the man who had sheep and goats, and Cain was the agriculturist. I mean, actually, if there was ever a justifiable homicide, it was probably Cain's destruction of Abel, because the followers of Abel, in fact, have performed incredible feats of destruction all over the world. The goat, which is closely related to the sheep, both of them are highly destructive. They are thin-lipped animals who pull up the grass by the roots and leave nothing. And the goat is much more active than the sheep and can even climb trees to eat its food. And it is quite fantastic what the goat has succeeded in destroying. It has destroyed the whole Mediterranean basin, probably, and the sheep, of course, has performed frightful destruction in Spain. One of the oddest chapters of Spanish history is the history of what was called the Mesta, the great sort of cooperative of the sheep herders, who were in perpetual conflict with the agriculturists, and who, in the course of about 300 years, succeeded in turning Spain almost into a desert. And goats still go on. Performing the most terrible feats of destruction. One of the worst things they do, of course, is entirely to prevent forests reproducing themselves, because they attack the young shoots as they come up, the young trees, and bite them down to the ground. So that if goats are at large, they absolutely prevent reforestation. And here I may say that one of the few really good things that can be said for the British in their occupation of Cyprus was that they did persuade the inhabitants of the forested west end of the island to give up their goats in favor of forests. It was all done quite democratically. Men went from village to village, the administrators went and talked to them about the relative advantages of goats, which are considerable here and now. But then the advantage of forests later on would be very much greater. And they did persuade a great many villages to tether their goats and to give up a certain proportion of them, with the result that there has been a remarkable revival of the forests on the mountains of western Cyprus. And until, for example, again in Lebanon, there is absolutely no prospect of reforestation until the goats are kept under control. I was told a story while I was there. The interesting thing about Lebanon is that it's divided politically along religious lines. I mean, there are the Muslims, the Druzes, the Maronites, the Armenians, the Greek Orthodox. And I was told a story of the Maronite bishop who came into the Ministry of Agriculture and saying, you will be glad to hear, Your Excellency, that we are doing very well with our goats in the mountains, but I regret to say the Orthodox goats are creating immense havoc still. And they go on creating these awful havocs in spite of all legal restraints. Great efforts have been made in Algeria and Tunisia, for example, to control the goats by law. But it's almost impossible to enforce these things. And these wildly destructive animals go on. In recent years, for example, the administration, actually it should have known better, in Madagascar, introduced a valuable kind of goat which produces some useful hair into southern Madagascar, with the result that about 25 years, only about 20% of the forest remains. It's incredible how rapid this destruction can go. Well, the overgrazing, as I say, is of enormous importance in the destruction of forests and grass and the creation of conditions of erosion. And equally important, of course, possibly more important, because it's been going on for longer, is fire. The geologists assure us that they find a notable increase in fossil ashes from the beginning of Pleistocene time, about 1 million years ago, which would seem to indicate that even at that very remote period, the man or his near-human ancestors had discovered fire. We know in any case that Pekin man, who dates undoubtedly from 250,000 years ago and possibly from 500,000, had fire. And there seems to be no question at all that fire has been consistently used by man to burn forests, used by the hunters to clear the forests, used in the actual process of hunting, and that accidental fires, of course, have been proceeding ever since. And, of course, this has been going on all over the world. The forest of Western Europe was largely cleared by fire. One sees the traces of this even in the place names in England. A name like Brentwood means just burnt wood. A name like Brindley means burned lea or burned clearing. And this procedure went completely on and has never stopped. And of course, in this country, one of the great tragedies has been the fabulous amount of forest destroyed by accidental fires. I was looking the other day at a record of these, and it is really incredible. On this coast, for example, there were fires in great fires in 1865 and 1868 in Washington, one of which destroyed 1 million acres, the other 600,000 acres. There were very few fires before the settlers arrived in 1847. After this, they were absolutely incessant. There was the great Idaho and Montana fire of 1910, which destroyed 8.5 billion feet of lumber. And one of the worst was the great Tillamook fire of 1933, which destroyed 12.5 billion feet of lumber, which was the equivalent of an entire year's production for the whole United States of that period. This is what the United States would have consumed in a year. And this in a single fire in a week was just wiped out. And this frightful plague goes on. Now it's the elaborate firefighting organizations have been created here, and it's not so bad, but of course anybody who sees the difficulty of controlling even a brush fire in California, we've had them recently, can realize that it's still profoundly difficult to control this engine of destruction. And when one reflects that in countries, for example, like Chile, these forest fires are completely without control and rage for weeks, blackening immense areas, one sees the enormous importance of this human geological force which has been released by man. Actually, it's been calculated that in Oregon, from the beginning till about 1908, when fire protection was installed, it was calculated that about 32 billion feet of lumber had been cut and used, but that about 40 billion feet had been destroyed accidentally by fire. This gives one a conception of the scale of the destruction which has gone on and which is unfortunately still going on, largely uncontrolled in many parts of the world. Well, this, of course, is a gloomy picture of what man is doing to his world, and unfortunately, it is a gloomy picture. There is there's very little way of making it non-gloomy. And in the lecture that I hope to give, not next week, but in the week after, I shall talk about try to make a bridge from these facts to the other side, to the problem of morality, the problem of what should be our philosophical views of nature, how we should think of these brute facts, not only in a purely practical way, but also in a kind of metaphysical and ethical and aesthetic way, which is, it is terribly important, I feel, that we should be able to think of these things with our whole nature, not merely as technologists, not merely as people who want to eat and to have timber products, but as total human beings with a moral nature, with an aesthetic nature, with a philosophical trend in our mind. And so, as I say, I've given the factual end of this planetary bridge, and in the next talk I shall try to talk about the other end, the purely human moral and aesthetic end. Thank you.